Buy a Damn site discusses the events and personal experiences relating to the flooding that took place in May of 2020 in Saginaw, Midland, and Gladwin counties in the state of Michigan. This content could be triggering to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to part two of my interview with Jerry Cole. And for some of us, we like to call him Jake. If you haven't listened to part one, please go back to hear how the timeline unfolded for the volunteer Jerome Township Fire Department during the flooding event in May of 2020. And without further ado, please enjoy. When multiple dams failed in May of 2020, the resulting devastation was shocking. We all have a story to tell. This is one way those stories get told. This is how we remember. This is how we heal. This is how we move forward. Buy a Damn Site.
If there's a couple things I could have people take away from this entire event that happened last year, number one, everybody needs to have a plan. Think about what can happen to your family, your community, be it weather, snow emergencies, house fire. Have a plan. Make sure your family members practice that plan. Everybody knows what you're doing. And I'm pleading with this because some of the rescues we had to do later on were kind of concerned me a lot. And it's very frustrating when you tell people that you need to get out and people don't. What's the number one reason you would not leave your house if somebody told you to evacuate?
I mean,
you don't want to be inconvenienced?
Yeah, I was going to say laziness. Like, yeah. And I'm not calling anybody lazy. I'm talking about the first in the
yep.
night
yes.
when you asked us to leave.
It's an inconvenience.
I just thought to myself, well, I just would rather stay home. I mean, I think we're being a little dramatic here. Like, yep. That's what I thought. So, please, no, I'm not calling anybody lazy. I'm talking about, yep. You're asking me,
yes.
Why would I stay home? Laziness.
Correct.
Because I don't want to leave my house. I just want to be. And Jake, we had been home for 2 months. We weren't able to leave.
Yeah.
I mean, we had just started opening up construction.
So, and speaking for myself too, the only reason I wouldn't leave if somebody told me to is an inconvenience. Speaking
right.
for myself, once again. But here's the thing. Your emergency services, this isn't anything foreign to them. Like the flood or other events, we've talked about it. We've looked at it. We've weighed the factual information, not what our uncle told us or not what we read on Facebook, the factual information, the science we have available to us. And we're saying for your own good, you need to leave. So you leave for a while, come back. But it's frustrating when you see people that have to go back in harm's way to get people out the den. That's our job. We'll do it. The one plea I'd have to make to people is, if the emergency services tell you to leave your home or leave here or don't go around that barricade or don't drive your car through here, don't do it. There's a good
right.
reason for it.
Right. I remember also, you know, my husband Jake and I having this conversation about, we had an opportunity to show our kids that when a police officer or a firefighter comes trying to protect you, you follow those requests,
yes.
right? So it was also a teaching moment. I didn't want my kids to think that, like, if a firefighter comes and tells you that this is not safe, you should leave, that you actually have a choice. And to your point, I think the preparedness isn't just about, like, being prepared to stay home, because I guess that's kind of what I was talking about, but also know, you know, who your people are, know where you can go, right?
Correct.
In the middle of the night.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, in the case of a house fire, where are you going to rendezvous with your family to make sure everybody got out okay?
Right.
So there's a lot of little things. FEMA's got a ton of great information out there on that. That's my lecture for the day.
Oh, okay, great. Yes. In the night, I'm assuming there's no peace. I mean, what do you do then? You can't do anything now. Like, it's just happening, right? Like, you can't do anything.
So that night, the night of the 19th going to the 20th, the amazing part was it was busy with evacuation, busy with damage assessment, figuring out what's going on. Because if the if the dam structure did fail, it would probably impact the city of Midland a little different. Get that information. Get the people out that didn't get out before via trucks, boats, whatever we had to use. But the amazing part was, and then all of a sudden it's over. It's calm. It's dark. And it's black. Everything's black. The town is dark. And we knew we were beginning to get worried. We were still in our old Station 1 at the corner of Irish and Saginaw at that time. And there's four pieces of equipment there. And we know that we have to have that equipment for later. And we had two pieces of equipment over on the other side at our Station 2 on the east side of the lake. So myself, Jerry Turner, Aaron Boxey, and Jordan Ortez stayed at Station 1. And our battalion or our deputy chief, Jim Bailey, stayed at the other station, Station 2. If we need to evac that equipment, we could get it out. But then it was just quiet for the longest time. And I finally went in the back of one of our rescue units and just curled up on a cot, took about a two-hour nap, getting ready for the next day because it's going to be game on. And it was. I mean, it started fast and furious the next morning and trying to plan and figure out what to do and prioritize what we're going to do next, work with the other agencies, EOC, community fire departments, different things like that. There's just a lot of busy work on Wednesday. People assumed that all the power lines that were down were dead for some reason. And trying to keep people away from that. And, it was keeping people safe was a full-time job on Wednesday.
Wednesday morning when you woke up, could you get to downtown?
No. Wednesday morning about 3:30, 4 o'clock a.m., there's a little dip by the Pine River where it comes up Saginaw Road as you're going towards Coleman. And I put a stake in the ground right there to see if the water was continuing to come up because it's getting closer and closer to our Station 1. And that's about 3:30, 4 o'clock when it actually started slowing down. And it was in the nighttime when it really started going down because we could not get in the village or anywhere that day. A lot of the day, Wednesday, was spent on just figuring out what roads you had, what roads were impassable, what roads were gone. Because remember, at that time, you could not get from the west side of the lake to the east side of the lake without going west on US 10, Tolton Lake, go up 55, come back down 71, come back into 10 that way.
Yeah.
So it was quite a drive. We were able to use the Tittabawassee Bridge on M30 for a little while that day. That got shut off and the DOT got there. So at the fire station at Saginaw Road and Irish Street, we set up because the bridge on Saginaw Road was underwater. The bridge on Irish Road was underwater. And I remember arguing with somebody that you cannot go down Irish Street. And they're arguing with me. And finally, I'm like, why are we arguing? Look.
Right.
There's 12 feet of water on that bridge.
Right.
I can't drive through that. Perfect.
Right.
On Wednesday, one of the things that, as we're putting plans together, we don't have any sort of off-road vehicle or anything else like that in the fire department. And we knew when the water started going out, based on our experience, there was going to be a lot of mud, clay, and river silt. I didn't know how much, and I was kind of surprised when we found it later on. But what I decided to do was, I have a four-door Jeep to set up for off-road with 38-inch tires and different things like that and winch. We staged that at the fire station, left the keys inside so that when the water went down, we could use that to get around. And I actually was able to get back to my home where I lived, and I was finally sleeping in a bed for the first time in a while. And so this is Thursday, May 21st. We get toned out at 4:11, and I was a little sleepy. And I'm thinking, okay, it's a natural gas leak. Well, it was the natural gas main that went through Sanford that broke. And I'm thinking, okay, yep, we just grab engine 421. I'll make sure I got two or three guys with me. We'll go down, secure the scene, hold it till consumers gets there, blah, blah, blah. And then when I finally got to my car and started going, I realized that I can't even drive there from here because the town's probably still flooded. But I drove down as far as I could, saw the sea of silt and clay. And I'm like, wow. And so I caught up to the station, and I had one of our firefighters, Mark Brown. He was about a three-year guy at that time. Get a couple air packs and some other miscellaneous equipment, gas monitoring stuff and different things like that, loaded into my Jeep and have it ready to go. So we got there and we hopped in it, and I thought for sure we were going to bury that Jeep downtown Sanford. And the clay and mud was terrible. We got by Center Street and Saginaw Road. Yep, and in fact, actually, from my house a half mile from that location, I could hear the gas leak. It was so loud. But so many gas lines and water lines were all severed. And so we get there at about 4:30 in the morning. Then the sun starts coming up. And that was the first time I saw downtown Sanford. And it's a moment I always remember. The buildings all shoved together, buildings tumbled. Buildings I recognize from a block that should be a block that way were all shoved into these buildings and different things like that. And I was not prepared for that. I knew it was going to be flooded, but I didn't expect to see the magnitude of damage I saw. So.
And, like, you're a person, right? Yeah. With a rich, deep history in Sanford. You've taken us through this timeline as fire chief, but I think that there's this whole other experience happening alongside you doing this as a fire chief, right? But you doing this as a person who loves your community, and to see it decimated like that.
It was almost easier doing the fire chief role because you know what your mission is. You're focused on it. You don't deal with a lot of the other things. You deal with the facts coming in, different things like that. And you're focused. But when I pause, took time out, and you start looking around all the damage, you're thinking, you know, I looked at the hardware, and all I could think was the amazing business Denny Cyan built up there. It's wiped out.
And we talk about this hardware in every episode. I mean, okay. I hope that this continues because we love that hardware.
We love that hardware. And here's the one thing. That hardware, the tangible asset, is a reflection of the guy that built it in his family. The Cyans are a longtime Sanford family and everything else like that. But so as the days progress and everybody's cleaning out and stuff and everybody's working, I see Denny Cyan cleaning a store out, and I know how hard it's got to be. My home was flooded twice, 86 and 2014. So I know how much work it is, and the feeling and the emotions you have to overcome. But I see this guy, and he's working 16 hours a day. And as things progress, and the fire department was front and center on a lot of things in Sanford during this time because we had an interface of so many people from churches. And I talked to college students from University of Michigan, things like that, just heard about it, and they wanted to come help. So you got all these people interfacing with the equipment, and we're trying to keep them safe because you got contractors that aren't used to working with people that don't know they have to stay away from the back and the swing radius of equipment and things like that. But so we're downtown a lot, and I see they finally got the hardware about cleaned out, and I thought, thank God, Danny will get a break, you know. Mm-hmm. And I look over, and there he is at the pizza shop helping them clean out their store.
What a guy.
What a guy. I mean, I mean, his whole world was turned upside down, but he's helping other people. That's Sanford, man.
That's a testament to this community, right?
Yep.
The kind of ecosystem that we cultivate, right? And I'm not saying it's perfect. It's,
nope.
You know, every community has their struggles, right? But when you look at the eagle eye view, I mean, people are inspired by what we as a community have been able to achieve in this area. It's unparalleled.
I'm going to go back to the fire department just for a minute. When it was all done over, we took a assessment of how many of the firefighters had damage to their house, anywhere from 3 inches of water to 5 feet. 70% of our firefighters had water in their house.
Mm-hmm.
They're still doing the job. My sister had 5 feet of water in her basement. Sandy Hook had about 3 or 4 feet in her basement up on the lake. And they were the ones that set up the emergency shelter Monday night at junior high school with Craig Harmony and some of the Lincoln Township firemen and a couple of our firemen set up all the beds and stuff like that. But and they knew their houses were flooded, but they stayed until 11 o'clock the next day when the Red Cross got there. So, I mean, yeah, it's just, I don't know if people are that dedicated everywhere in the country or not, but I mean, we sure saw some amazing stuff here. The contractors that came out and were helping clean up, and just, like I said, college students from the University of Michigan to trade schools to, it was just an unbelievable workforce downtown.
Absolutely. So. And, you know, I think we've talked about the businesses, but I know that a lot of people lost a lot of things, and some people lost, you know, their entire home. And, you know, we think about the celebration going on along Porty Park, right? That's still, I mean, that's an exciting time, but it's still kind of somber back there, right?
Yeah.
I remember during Sanford Shines, you know, when we drove in that parade, kind of trying to hide my face because I was crying so hard. Like, I didn't want people, it was so emotional to see something so beautiful, but you can't help but feel that immense loss for people. And I, you know, I'm not trying to say, oh, poor me, pity party, but, you know, there is survivor's guilt, right? Like,
right.
There's this guilt that goes along with, like, I lost nothing, you know, and I'm over here crying about a lake, you know, and these people lost everything.
Yeah.
And I think that that's so, that's such a sign of humanity, right? And I know I'm not the only person that feels that way. And you just wish that you had all of the answers and knew how to make it go faster and make these people whole, but it's going to take time and
yeah.
It's going to take money. And that's the reality of the situation.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, reflecting back on it, just go back to that Thursday morning when I realized how bad our town was. And then the reality hit home that we hadn't had any reported loss of life or serious injury at that point in time. But you start looking at that devastating damage, and you know it's out there. Somewhere, somebody didn't get out. Somewhere. In fact, the Tuesday night of the flood, the first time I really met Rebecca Johnson, I was trying to figure out how to get to the lakeside of the dam. And I got to Cedar Street, and it was, I think you could have wakeboarded down Cedar Street. And I like, I can't get through there. And I turned to look at the back out, and I'm driving a one-ton utility truck. And I look, and there's this lady looking in my window. I'm like, what are you doing here? Get out. And she goes, I want to, but there's a guy in my house. I'm like, ma'am, you're not going to get any law enforcement. You got a guy in your house. You're going to have to deal with that later, but we got to go. She goes, no, he was trying to help me. He went down my basement. And I'm like, he's in your basement, that house over there. And I knew I couldn't get across the road without getting swept away. And I told her she couldn't either. I'm like, you sure he's in your basement? Yes, he's trying to blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, did you try calling him? She goes, yeah, it goes right to voicemail.
Oh, no.
So I'm thinking, this is our first. This is the first, and it's going to be a cascading series of events now. And what's his name? She told me. So I started calling his name on the PA speaker on the electronic siren in the truck. Pretty soon he walks to the house. What? Get out of there.
Oh, my goodness. Were you just like, oh, my gosh.
My gosh, yeah.
Thank you, Jesus.
Yes. I mean, because, number one, I'm going to have to tell this lady that if he's not answering, we'll come back in a couple of days, but it's not looking good for the home team. But there's more people at risk right now. So, but, okay, so we dodged that one. But then when I saw the damage on Thursday morning, and we were meeting the National Guard at the fire station at 9 a.m. to rally and start a door-to-door search of the disaster area. And so by the time we got out of there, got to the station, the National Guard started reporting into the fire station. And we were joined by about a 6 to 8 members of the Coleman Fire Department came down to help us as well. And you got to love those guys. Great group of guys. And so we had 47 guardsmen with 14 large all-terrain trucks, the type you see that, I mean, they can go anywhere and do anything. So we partnered up with either Coleman firefighters or our firefighters and did the door-to-door. And if you see any of the buildings or houses with X's on the windows with duct tape, that's the houses we checked. And we identified gas leaks and different things like that. So that was an odd day project. And that was the first time I think I really exhaled that nobody lost their life yet. I mean, no serious injuries yet. And then, you know, of course, you start getting into this person's missing, that person's missing. And I was involved in a number of different going in with the sheriff department or just the fire department because there wasn't anybody else available. House checks and going room to room. And this is by Friday, Saturday after the flood. So you're going to some of these houses and they're full of river water. They already stink, so you don't know if what's causing that stink. So, and one of the houses is the one I built, and all the furniture piles together down with the current, and you got to tear it all apart and see what you can find. The last house I was involved in, I'm like, I can't believe we're going to get out of this, and nobody's missing, and we're accounting for people, and anybody's missing, we're going the whole route until we physically find that person. So, yeah, it was, I still sat here, and when you look at the damage yesterday, trying to believe that not only was there no loss of civilian life or serious injury, none of the firefighters are doing this stuff high speed were hurt. Not a fire truck was damaged. I'm amazed. I still am today.
The main thing that comes to mind for me is trust. Like, I feel like that's a real sign of trust that the community has in their, what do I want to call it, fire team? In their
fire department.
Yeah. The trust that the community has in their fire department, and then the folks on the fire department, the trust that they have for each other, right? Because I think in those moments, right, like everybody's trying to be in charge and everybody's trying to make, you know, do a lot of things at the same time. And, in you know, working in the shops, we learn that, like, when you go fast and you're not following procedure, right, that's when people get hurt.
Yep.
So there was a plan in place. That plan was executed, and they trusted each other.
Yeah. And, you know, so you're looking at days with little sleep, and I was getting encouragement from some of my fellow chiefs, make sure your people are rehabbing. And I'm like, I'm trying to send them home, but they won't go.
Yeah.
And when I finally drew the line after the search on Thursday that, all right, this is it. I mean, I had some guys like Aaron Boxey and Jordan Ortez and Connor Smith, and they were front and center on everything. It's time y'all go home, take a 24-hour nap, and I'll see you later.
Right.
So
they probably, of course, had to be told, right?
Oh, they did. But, of course, I didn't follow my own advice. I had to go downtown and see what's happening. And I go downtown. Every fireman I sent home is downtown helping people clean out businesses.
That's amazing.
So.
Amazing.
A couple of things I contributed to a lot of success, like when you talk about prioritizing and it seemed to be organized, it was. I mean, there was a plan. There was a lot of communications. And one of the other things behind the scenes, when there's a lot of tension, a lack of sleep, a lot of pressure, people can get testy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember a harsh word or any sort of real profanity or anger or anything like that with the group. Everybody was focused on what had to be done. And so three things you got going for you. We had a plan, a solid plan in place. We have a very capable fire department. A lot of these folks have had extensive training. Jerry Turner, for example, he did operations command the night of the flood while I was doing incident command, and he has, I think, 13 different classes in incident command. So very well-trained person. He came from the state of Michigan with that, and you have so many other people that were involved there as either paramedic, law enforcement, Dow Emergency Services. But then we're blessed because we had so many structural damages, the people that know construction. Jordan Ortiz understands residential construction, all these sort of folks. And Tim Hammond, who was a godsend because he was part of that tabletop exercise in September 2019. So you have this very well-trained fire department. The members are all highly motivated. So you got the plan, you got the fire department, and the other I give a lot of kudos to, Central Dispatch.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa Haw at 911 will always be a rock star in my book and her team. A typical 24-hour day is like 250 calls. The first 24 hours of that flood, they handled just about 1,400 calls. It was like 1,380 or some.
That takes my breath away.
And they had like seven. Their goal is to have calls answered within 10 seconds. They had seven, then they get an answer in 10 seconds. And when you talk to them on the radio, because they're getting a lot of things from a lot of people. We need consumers. We need barricades. We need law enforcement. We need this. And I forget how many radio traffics they had. It was in the tenth of thousands, but there was never an upset dispatcher, never anybody that, I mean, it was professional all the way. They were awesome. So Lisa always gets mad when I labor that so much, but it was. I mean, they're a godsend.
What do you see as, like, the most surprising? Like, what was the thing that, you know, just made your jaw hang open?
Okay, reemphasize, number one was no loss of life. Number right. two, the outpouring of help. Like I said, I mean, it was from churches. It was from school groups. It was college students. Dan, the young man that brought us equipment up here for, and he's in a fire department down in the southern part of the state towards the border. He was here for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. I mean, not looking for not charging anybody anything, not taking anything, just doing whatever he could to help. And there was just so many people that were like that. And the church groups and the Amish folks and others that were bringing food. I'd finally lost a few pounds right before that flood, and I gained about 10 pounds during the flood. Because every time you turn around, there was somebody with an amazing home-cooked meal handing it to you.
Yeah, right. I remember you talking about brownies, too.
Oh, good Lord, yes. But somebody we probably don't talk about enough, too, is the Mayette family at Food Pride. I remember when I walked in to get some stuff for the fire department. That was before all the food started rolling in, you know, just to make sure we had something to feed people. And I got up to the counter, and then I realized that somewhere over the last couple of days, I don't have my billfold on me. I mean, even before I could say it, they were like, go, take it, go. I mean, they let people use the parking lot, whatever they could do to help. That's another one of those Sanford families you just can't beat.
Absolutely. I mean, I know I've said this before, but I don't know what we would do without that grocery store.
Oh, my worst fear was we're going to lose that somewhere along the line because... Yep, they have a generator, but so many people had lost natural gas. And that Thursday, I mean, when the water drained out of Sanford over Wednesday night into Thursday morning, we were going to natural gas leaks everywhere. And I just waiting for that to happen. Once again, I'm one of the people that caught IGA yet. So
yes.
But
IGA forever.
Yes.
So I hate to do this.
Okay.
But I got to give COVID a little... airtime. I know COVID has brought complexities to this situation. Let's talk about some of the complexities that trying to rebuild and having an influx of people show up to help in the middle of a global pandemic. Now, lots of people say COVID died in Sanford in May of 2020.
Yeah.
And I respect that and I understand it. But at the end of the day, everybody had different levels of comfort.
Yeah, and that was obvious when Denise and Sandy set up the emergency shelter up to the school. They actually paid attention to try and keep the cots 6 feet apart because Midland County does have a trailer we keep at our station, too, with a lot of cots in it. And the guys set them up all 6 feet apart or so. And they had probably a dozen families that stayed out in their car out in the parking lot because they didn't want to come in because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And all these groups started rolling into Sanford. The fire department was still trying to respect COVID and do the right things, social distance, mask, 6 feet. Keep in mind, while all this is going on, we're still getting our usual business with rescue runs and different things like that. So try to remember to wear a mask on that. And when we set up the first aid stations, that whenever there's peak workloads, we always try to have at least one first aid station in Sanford, manned by first responders or EMTs. And we'd have masks there and stuff like that. But yeah, it was always a consideration in the back of the mind because to date, since COVID started, about a little over 40% of our fire departments have been impacted, but either they've had it or they've been quarantined because of it. So it's, as a chief that's responsible for everybody, it's always there in the front of my mind. Now, I got to say one thing. When they were cleaned up downtown Sanford the week after the flood, and there's end loaders and excavators and skidsters and dump trucks and gravel trains moving, and probably wasn't front and center of my mind that much. I was more worried about people getting backed over or breaking over.
Sure.
But yeah, it's got to be a concern.
I want to ask this question because, you know, I ask this question to a lot of people. In your mind, in all of this, and I know that this is very low priority compared to some of the things that you were dealing with during this time, but especially because you grew up here, in your mind, was the water ever gone?
Absolutely not. I mean, like I said, growing up, my dad is fire chief, and we always talked a little bit about what if the dam failed, what would happen. Never did I think we were going to wind up with a situation like this. I've never imagined it.
What do you see as the next right steps to recovery for Sanford and for the surrounding area?
As a fire chief?
Yes.
First off, I'm going to start right out with saying that we were so blessed to have, what's that lady's name again? Dolores. Yeah. Who is that? We never hear her name.
Porte.
There's a park named after. Is it Veterans Park?
No.
Dolores Porte. And Dolores and I met back in 2016. That was the year we both retired. And she is an amazing person. So having her and Dave Kepler, I get very discouraged when I see things wrote about Four Lakes Task Force or Dave. And I don't know Dave personally. I've met him a few times, but don't know him personally. But to have people of Dolores and Dave's caliber leading the things that need to be done right now with their experience, their education, different things like that, the plans they have put out there, you know, rebuilding the park, all the efforts going on, focusing on housing, mm-hmm. and getting the lakes back, and to actually tell you strategically what the next step should be, I haven't really focused on that much because I hate to say it, but I really have been busy with the fire department.
Of course.
We're just finishing our new fire station there. But the direction they're taking, I think it's everything I agree with, bringing the community back together, the activities to keep the focus on. We're doing a lot with the Midland Daily News, and they're doing a lot to keep that front and center along with a lot of the other news programs. Keep it in front of people.
And so what I think I hear you saying is the right next steps are to be supportive of these folks who are trying to lead the way in recovery and support, you know, the village council.
Yes.
To support the Four Lakes Task Force, to make sure that your voice and your talents can be shared when you see, you know, an opportunity for you to do that.
Yeah, there's very few people out there, but there are a few that would rather attack things than try and figure out how they can help. If people use their time and energy to support the village council, the Four Lakes Task Force, and other efforts, it's going to be a lot better for everybody. We're going to get to the end goal a lot quicker.
So when you look back on this entire experience, I've already mentioned that, you know, you are fire chief, but then there's Jerry Cole, the fire chief.
Yes.
And then there's my friend Jake Cole.
Yes.
Your experience, like, do you find that you are healing from that situation? You know, is Jake Cole healing from the loss that he has suffered in the town of Sanford? And is Jerry Cole, the fire chief, is he optimistic for the future? Or are both optimistic? Like,
so first off, Jerry Cole, the fire chief.
Yes.
I am in a very good place. So let's take a look. So I became fire chief back in May. And one of the reasons I wanted to be chief was I didn't think we were capitalizing on the talents and the energy of the group we had. And turn those people loose. So since May last year, with the floods, with the pandemic, everything else we've had going, we started a cadet program. We have two amazing young people in our program now, and one of them just put an application in. She'll be turning 18 in the near future. But we have a cadet program up and running, and we're going to be working more with Meridian Early College about how to provide some curriculum for them. So That's amazing. We've implemented our first computer management tool for the fire department for doing the reports and managing our business, be it inventories, truck maintenance, things like that. I mean, it feels like we're from the Dow Corning HSC world, things like that. So we can keep an accurate record on things. When we apply for grants, the information is more readily available because people like Connor Smith stepped up, implemented this computer program that cost $2,000. I mean, those sort of things. Sandy Hoka, she's another rock star. Since she's been in the department, she's gotten the department $48,000 in grants. So Jerry Cole, the fire chief, is elated. And if we could do all this during a pandemic and a national state disaster, I can't wait to see what we could do in a good year. But are Jake Cole the person? I am still heartbroken for all the people that lost so much. All the people, everybody that lost our lake, which is such, you said it so well in your one line at the end of the show that you'll spend the rest of your days being thankful for the things you never knew you could lose. And that's so true because I never thought we'd ever lose the lake. And it takes me back to a time with my dad when they were taking the train tracks out of Sanford. And he was standing up there just kind of watching them tear the tracks up. And I'm like, what you thinking, Dad? He's like, they're taking the train tracks that haul products all around this country. Because my dad saw that train track put there.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the dam taken up and it turned into the lake. He saw that. And we were talking. He said, I never thought I'd see the train tracks leave before they got rid of the lake and put the farmland back. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting. But the lake... Even I've never lived on it, but I've played on it a lot, obviously.
Sure.
How important it is to everybody. So, anyhow. But and I think that'll be another step in getting back to normal. So,
I am sure your team is endless. And I'm sure there are so countless folks, you know, that you would recognize and thank. But, you know, I want to give you the opportunity to just, you know, give a shout out to those, you know, maybe some of those folks who especially stand out to you over the last year.
Yeah, I've got to start out with each and every member of the Jerome Township Fire Department. Boy, they've been challenged so much in 2020 and 21. And not only did they meet the challenges, but they made the department a better place. I mean, we moved into the new fire station. That took a lot of work. The cadet program, the grants they've gotten, implementing a new computer management system. They're an amazing group of people. But and I do have a list. I'm going to keep moving right along. Central Dispatch, Lisa Hall and her team, rock stars. I think the world know all of them. They did so much during the flood, and they do so much all the time. People just don't realize it. The American Legion, all the help they did the night of the evacuations. They set up the center there to help flood victims. They did so many different things. Mark Othier, who was a big part of that, who recently passed with COVID. I hope he rests in peace. Annette Glenn. I don't think we ever talk enough about Annette Glenn. There is a person all day long. She was front and center down Lansing taking care of business to get us money and different things like that. And you see her up here at meetings at 9 o'clock at night. I'm not a huge... I don't hang around with too many politicians, but... Annette Glenn is not a politician. She's public service, just like Dolores Porte. I have to send a personal thanks out to City Fire Chief Chris Coughlin and Deputy Chief Josh Mosher. They did so much for this community during the flood and afterwards, sharing their expertise, anything they could, along with the rest of the Midland County fire community, the fire chiefs like John Hansen, Bill Cozad from Coleman, Roger Dufresne from Edenville. They've been amazing help for all of us. Just a couple more real quick. Clear Fire Department. They brought water down. They did whatever they could to help us. They'd send manpower. Sanford Strong, Team Ricky Hatfield. You got to love those folks. Midland Daily News for keeping the story alive. And I got, this is going to be a little selfish moment, but I got to touch my family. My wife. Yeah, my wife always supported. for my son during the flood, making sure his mom was safe because she wasn't leaving the house right at first, and he went and made sure she did. So kudos to him. My son-in-law, Rod, keeping an eye on the house and everything else like that for the entire family, keeping everybody safe. I couldn't do my job without them.
Well, I want to take a moment and say thank you to you. You have always been a leader. You should always lead. This is exactly who you're supposed to be. And I'm not sure, you know, I think that the love you have for Sanford is so special. And I think that, you know, not only did you act with as a leader, but you acted with heart as well. So we appreciate you. We see you and we support you. So from the bottom of my heart, on behalf of Sanford, I just want to say thank you to you.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Well, Jake, I can't thank you enough for coming to my podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, this was a great conversation. I look forward to being able to celebrate with you and the fire department in the future.
Thank you, Sarah Jo.
Thank you, Jake. Take care. Thanks to all my listeners who have tuned in, especially to these episodes highlighting the contributions that the Jerome Township Fire Department have made to the community over the last 12 months. If you'd like to support this podcast, please like us on Facebook, or you can leave a review wherever you listen to your podcast. Don't worry, there's plenty more interviews to come. Until next time, friends. By a Dam site should not be considered a single source of truth relating to the events and history discussed. My mission is to give people a platform to share their experiences just as they remember them. With that in mind, listeners should expect varying accounts of dates, times, and sequences of events. When people take the time to share their story with us, I allow them to do just that. I've said many times since the loss of the lakes that I will spend the rest of my days being thankful for the things I didn't even know I could lose. My people are my team. Art and logo collaboration with Breanne Helzel and Dennis Diener. Lead swag consultant Dennis Diener. Editing support and quality control from my husband Jacob Rowley. Equipment and audio support by Mitchell Boyce. My silent partners who support every wild idea I ever dream up, Selena Dodman and Kelly Stimson. And finally, thanks, Mom.